Okay, we're going to begin here on the top of Mem Tet Amud Aleph. The Gemara begins with a Mishnah. Over here, the Mishnah says, Arba'asar shechaliot b'Shabbat. The 14th falls out on Shabbat. Mivarim et hakol mifnei Shabbat. You have to do biur, you have to remove or rid yourself of all the chametz prior to Shabbat. Divrei Rabbi Meir. Chamim omrim bizmano. You do it at the normal time, at the regular time. Belazav Rabbi Tzadok omer, Chumam lifnei Shabbat. Chumah you do prior to Shabbat. V'chulin bizmanan. Whereas chulin you do at the regular time. The problem is obvious that if the 14th is on Shabbat, then biur chametz will turn out to be on Shabbat itself, and most of the normal processes involved in biur chametz, including strefa, cannot be done on Shabbat itself. So what did we do in this case where there is a need or necessity for biur chametz on Shabbat? The Meir suggests that it should all be completed before Shabbat. You get rid of all the chametz, whether it's chulin, whether it's truma, get rid of everything before Shabbat except gedei achilato, enough for you to eat over Shabbat itself, or the meals of Shabbat itself, but otherwise you have to get rid of everything. On the other hand, the Chachamim say, Bizmano, you do it like any other year, you take care of it, you get rid of it. You may not be able to rid yourself of the chametz like you do every other year, but you still can do the biur, or at least different forms of the biur, on Shabbat itself. Blazav Rabbi Tzadok separates between Truma and Chulin, because Chulin has numerous consumers, numerous eaters, and even if you live over a lot of Chulin, there are ways to dispose of it, or you can engage others to help you rid yourself of this chametz. On the other hand, truma has a limited public, a limited number of people who can consume it, and you can't just keep it over and hope that someone's going to show up, because you also know who those people are, and they're not going to be a surprise all of a sudden that someone's going to eat it or eat more than normal, and therefore you have to get rid of the truma prior to Shabbat, whereas the chulin you take care of during the zman in the regular time, because there you do have numerous eaters or numerous consumers that can eat the chametz. So Tanya, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Tzadok Omer, Pamachat, Shabbat Abba B'Yavna. Father was over in Shabbat in Yavna, Chalabas Saliot B'Shabbat. And was this case exactly, the 14th fell out on Shabbat, Erev Pesach was on Shabbat, Uba Zonin Mimunesh Rabbi Gamliel, Zonin who was the appointee of Rabbi Gamliel, Ve'amar, and he said, Higia Eit Leva'eret HaChametz. Time to go do Bir HaChametz. Valachti Achar Abba, and I followed my father, Ubiaron with the chametz. We got rid of chametz. So he's bringing evidence to the fact that they actually did bir chametz on Pesach itself. Now, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Tzadok does not necessarily disagree with the chachamim. He says for chulin that the din is that you do bir chametz kiragil on Pesach itself, and that's what the story over here suggests, that they were doing bir chametz even though our Pesach was on Shabbat itself. Okay, next mishnah. Ha'avleich lishkote pischo v'lamul et bino. Someone is going to do the Korban HaPesach, he's going to shecht his Korban HaPesach, or lamul et bino, or to give milah to his child. V'lechol sudat erusin bebeit chamiv. Or he's going to partake of the meal around, or the sudah that surrounds the erusin. V'nizkar sheishlo chametz betoch beito. And suddenly he recalls that he left, and in his house he had left chametz behind. Im yachol lachzor levaer, if he can go back home, eliminate, rid himself of that chametz, v'lachzor l'mitzvato, and then continue on his merry way to do the mitzvah that he was going to do, yachzor v'yeve'er. Then he should go back and take care of it. V'im lav, if it's impossible, I mean if he's to return to go the bir chametz, he'll miss out on the other items, mivatlo bilibo, then he can do bito b'lev, and that'll be okay, because we know that the Gemara said earlier that mido raito, mina Torah, bito ba'al masogi. It's enough just to do bittul. So if you do bittul, it is sufficient. Now, the Chachamim insisted that you also do bdika, that we do additional items. But over here, where he's stuck in a very difficult situation on his way to do mitzvot that are serious mitzvot, therefore the Chachamim waived their requirement that he do the bdika, the dinim of the Chachamim, and he can simply do bittul b'leiv, and that will take care of everything. Right, I don't think mevatlo bilibo is not a idea. It doesn't say it out loud, doesn't articulate what he's saying. Mevatlo bilibo means simply that he doesn't engage physically. He's not going to do anything with it. Mevatlo bilibo is he simply is doing something or saying something that, in this sense, is intangible. He's not engaged with the chametz. He's not touching the chametz. So I don't think it's a description of him saying it silently to himself, but rather it's just that he's not going to physically do the bidika. He's not going to physically engage with the chametz. So I wouldn't take it to mean mevatlo bilibo that he is articulating it quietly or silently. Rather, he articulates it. It's just that he's nowhere near the chametz. So bilibo is that it's all dependent on his feelings or on his thoughts regarding the chametz. Now, if let's say min anachrim, or min anar, he's going there to save Jews from an attack, or he's going to save a city from flooding, from a river, from some natural disaster, min alistim, or from robbers, min adzleika, from fire, min amopolet, from some sort of avalanche, yivatel belibo. Then in all these cases, we say that he should be mevatel belibo. In this case, we don't even ask him to consider the possibility of going back home. In the other cases where he has a mitzvah that he's doing, and there's a possibility of engaging in the mitzvah plus doing the bir chametz, we say do both of them. But over here, in this case where he's engaged in something that is what we call an emergency, something that requires his full attention, we don't want in any way to distract him to say, oh, maybe he should go back. No, we say engage in whatever you're supposed to be doing, and be mevatel belibo, and that's how you'll deal with this chametz. Now, v'lishbot shvitat harishut. He goes ahead and he wants to rest, a rest that is optional. Now, Rashi describes it because of the word shvita. Shvita means that he's creating an eruv tchumin. He's laying down an eruv tchumin, and the purpose of this eruv tchumin is one of rishut, that he's going out of the tchum for his own personal benefit, that he wants to go out of the tchum, he wants to go to a place that is further in that direction. So therefore, he creates a eruv tchumin in order to allow himself to do that. So if it's lishbot shvitat harishut as opposed to for a mitzvah, that he's putting out an eruv in order to go to Beit HaAvel or to Beit HaMishteh, where there is a mitzvah for him to be in attendance, so this is in distinction or as opposed to that, then yachzor miyad, he has to go back immediately. Because in this case, the only thing he's doing is his own personal benefit. It's not that he's engaged in a mitzvah. It's not that he's on his way to do something that of public good. And therefore, we say to him, go back home and take care of the chametz. We're not going to grant you this dispensation. That's the way Rashi reads Lishbot Shvitat HaRashut. Tosafot, on the other hand, says, wait a minute. We had in the Gemara Eruvin that really you're only supposed to put down an Eruv for a Dvar Mitzvah. You're not even supposed to put an Eruv down for a Dvar Rashut. And therefore, this would be against. This Mishnah would be problematic for the one who says that you can only put an Eruv down for a Dvar Mitzvah. Yet the Gemara never asks from this Mishnah. So that certainly can't be what it's speaking about. V'nir Ali, the Hachi Perisho, the Shbot Shvitat Rashut, Sholech, the Samoach, the Pesach, the Beit Oavo Krovo. He's going away for vacation. He's going to some cruise or an island or something on Pesach to celebrate on Pesach. So it's something that's for his own personal benefit, his own personal enjoyment. And that's what it means, Lishbot Shvitat Rashut. Not that he's setting up a tchum, he's just on his way. He's traveling. As opposed to all the instances beforehand in the Mishnah where he's traveling for things that are not for his own personal benefit, either because it's a mitzvah or for the public good, or he's doing some sort of saving or emergency management. In those cases, we don't tell him to go back. Over here, where he's going for his own personal benefit, we tell him to go back home and take care of it. Someone leaves Yerushalayim, and he suddenly remembers that he has basar kodesh that he was supposed to keep inside of Yerushalayim. Imavar tzofim, if he's past the tzofim, Sofo bimkomo, then he's allowed to burn it in place. Vimlav, if not, chuzer v'sorfo lifnei abira, then he must go back to Yerushalayim, back to the Mikdash, and burn it v'yantzei amaracha from the wood of the Mizbeach. So here we have an instance where we have a similar concept, which is, until a certain point we say to you, you must go back and take care of the issue. But in another case, when you're past this point, you're past that threshold, we say to you, deal with it on the spot, take care of it. So over here, that is tzofim. It goes to Yerushalayim. We're talking about here a korbanot that are eaten throughout Yerushalayim. That's kodshim kalim. So here you have kodshim kalim, which he leaves Yerushalayim with. Then he has to bring it back to the Mikdash. Now, birah is machloket, Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, whether birah refers to the Mikdash as a whole, or is birah a specific location on Har Habayit or in the Mikdash. But he has to bring it back. It seems, according to Tosfot, there's only a din d'rabbanon over here that has to bring it back, because we're talking about kodshim kalim. Whereas kodshei kodashim, there, as Rashi points out, we have a pasuk in the Torah, which says that, bakodesh ba'esh tisaref, that when you burn it, it has to be done bakodesh. So Tosfot says that's limited to kodshei kodashim, things that are only eaten within the azara. Those have to be brought back min ha-Torah. Because if it's something that's an obligation in a Torah, then the Chachamim can't give you a dispensation just because you're too far away. So it has to be talking about a case here where it's not something you're obligated midoraita, but only midorabanan. So Tosafot differentiates between kodshei kodashim, which are limited to be eaten in the Azara, where you are obligated to bring them back mina Torah, versus what we're discussing here in our Mishnah, which are kodshim kalim, that can be eaten throughout Yerushalayim. They must be brought back in mi derabanan. Now, where is that line around Yerushalayim where you must bring it back in? That is Tzofim. So, Iv Avar Tzofim. Rashi over here, Tzofim, says Tzofim is a kfar. It's a village on the outskirts of Yerushalayim. And once you pass that village, then you don't have to come back again. The Rabbanan didn't obligate you to come all the way back in to Yerushalayim to burn it, but you have to burn it on the spot. If you're closer than that, then they obligated you to backtrack and go back into Yerushalayim. That's the way Rashi describes it over here. Tosafot takes issue with Rashi's explanation and says Tzofim is not a place, but rather it's a generic description of any place around Yerushalayim from which you can't see Yerushalayim. Tzofeh, it's a place that you look out from around Yerushalayim and can still see Yerushalayim. So it's a circumference around Yerushalayim that's called Tzofim. What's interesting is if you go to Pei Aleph Amud Bet in the Gemara there, the Mishnah, Rashi over there says, or describes Tzofim like Tosafot. So interesting over there, Rashi takes the same approach as Tosafot to explain Tzofim, not as a specific location, but as a generic description, whereas over here, he says it's a specific far, a village outside of Yerushalayim. So, imavar tzofim tzofo minkumo, v'lav chozer v'tzofo lifnei abira, me'atzei amarach avad, kamayin chozerin. How much? What's the size for which you must return? That question is posed both with regards to chametz as well as with regards to kodesh. How big does it have to be when we obligate you to bring it back? Rabbi Meir Omer, ze v'ze b'kabetza. Both of them have to be the size of a kabetza to obligate you to come back. Both the chametz has to be the size of a kabetza to force you to come back and deal with it, as well as the kodesh over here has to be the size of a kabetza to force you to come back and burn it in Yerushalayim. Yehuda Omer, ze v'ze b'kazayit, that the threshold or the shiur that will obligate you to go back is a kazayit, not a kabetza. Chachamim Omerim, there's a difference between them. Basar kodesh b'kazayit. When it comes to kodesh, the amount is a kazayit. B'chametz, whereas chametz is b'kabetza, which the Gemara will discuss the reasoning behind each of their positions. Okay. Now the Gemara says, Reminu, I have a question. Astira. Holech lechol sudat erusim bebeit chamiv. Someone is going to eat his sudat erusim, that's the meal of his betrothal, in his father-in-law's house. Vilishbot shvitat arishut. Or he's going to do as optional shvita, again, depending like Rashi, who says that it's talking about Eruv Tchumin, or Tosafot, it's talking about that you're traveling for your own purposes, for your own vacation. Yachzor miyad, you have to return right away. So you see from here that Sudat Erusin is not considered to be a mitzvah, but it's rather in the category of Rishut. Whereas in our Mishnah, it's enumerated in the first three items. You have Olech Lishkod Pisko, Lamolet Beno, V'lechol Sudat Erusin B'Beit Chamiv. So there in the Mishnah, it enumerates it as one of the items that's considered to be a mitzvah that we don't force you to come back for, but rather just to do bitul. So we have the Mishnah saying it's a mitzvah, and we have the Braita suggesting that it's in the category of reshut, it's in the category of optional, something that you have to go back and deal with the chametz and not be exempt. So I'm Rabbi Yochanan Lokash, Ha Rabbi Yehuda, Ha Rabbi Yossi. This is a machloket tanaim with regards to the standing of Sudat Erusim, Detanya. Sudat Erusim Rashut, Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda believes that Sudat Erusim is not a Sudat mitzvah. It's rather, it's a nice thing. It's a Sudah, but it's not something that's considered to be a Sudat mitzvah. Rabbi Yossi Mer, mitzvah. Rabbi Yossi says that it is a mitzvah, the Sudat Erusim. Vahash Todam Rav Chista. Rav Chista qualified the machloket between Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda. Machloket b'Sudah Shnia. That's only in the second Sudah. Sudah Rishona, Divrei Hakol mitzvah. Everybody agrees that the Sudat Erusin is a mitzvah. Even Rabbi Yehuda agrees that the Sudat Erusin is considered to be a Sudat mitzvah. So then, Afilu Tema, ha Rabbi Yehuda. Then you can explain both the Braita and our Mishnah according to Rabbi Yehuda. Velokasha, ha b'Sudah Rishona. Our Mishnah is discussing the first meal, which is when it's considered to be a mitzvah. Ha b'Sudah Shnia, the Braita is discussing the second meal when it's not considered to be a mitzvah. And what is that? Why is the Sudat Shnia not? So, Tanya, I'm Rabbi Yehuda, ani lo shemati, ela Sudat Erusin. The only time I heard that it was a mitzvah is when you're talking about Sudat Erusin, which is again the meal of the Erusin itself, aval lo sivlonot, but not the meal of the gifts. As Rashi explains that the practice in their day was to first of all have a meal. When they first got engaged, they would have a meal to celebrate that. And that was the Sudat Mitzvah, that was the Sudat Erusin, where everybody agrees, according to Rav Chista, that that is a Sudat Mitzvah. In addition to that, the Chatan, after the Sudat Erusin, used to go back home and then send gifts to his future wife and to the house of his future father-in-law. And then he used to return in order to enjoy or partake in those gifts along with the family. So that was a secondary celebratory meal that was done in honor of the Erusin. But here, it's not necessarily associated directly with the mitzvah of Erusin. And that's why Rabbi Yehuda believes it's not considered to be a Sudat Erusin, rather a Sudat Rashut. It's an optional Sudat. It's nice. It is connected to the Erusin, but it's not directly correlated with the Erusin. And therefore, it's because Sudat Rashut, as opposed to the Sudat that is at the time of the Erusin, that is a Sudat Mitzvah. So Amar Lo Rabbi Yossi, Ani Shamati Sudat Erusin Visiv Lonot. Rabbi Yossi disagrees and says that both Sudot are considered to be Sudot Mitzvah, because that was the common practice around the Erusin. It's all considered to be a part of the bigger picture of Erusin, the Sivlanot as well. So Tanya, Rabbi Shimon Omer, Ko Seuda Sheina Shel Mitzvah, any Seuda that is not a Seuda Mitzvah, Ein Talmid Chacham Rashai Lehanot Mimena. Talmid Chacham should not be partake or be benefiting from it. Kigon Mai, what is considered to be something that's not a Seudat Mitzvah? I mean, what is a Seudat Rashut? Obviously, it doesn't mean a simple Seudat Rashut, something of levity, something that is inappropriate for a Talmid Chacham to be it, but rather here we're describing something that seems to be a Seudat Mitzvah, but should not be attended by a Talmid Chacham because it's not Shel Mitzvah. Rabbi Yochanan can go, Bat Kohen L'Yisrael. If a daughter of a Kohen, she is a Bat Kohen, marries Yisrael. Ubat Talmid Chacham Na'am Aretz. Or the daughter of a Talmid Chacham marries an Am Aretz. Da'amar Rabbi Yochanan, Bat Kohen L'Yisrael, En Zivugam Oleh Yafeh. A Bat Kohen that marries Yisrael, their Shidduch will not go so well, as Rashi says. It will not be for a Mazal Tov. Mahi. What's the going to happen? What's the problem? Amar Rav Chista, O Amana, O Grusha, O Zera Ein La. That either she'll end up as a widow, she'll end up divorced, or she'll end up without children. It's based on the Pasuk in Parshat Emor, which is Vat Kohen Ki Tiel Ish Zar. There it's referencing what happens in terms of her status with regards to Truma. It says there, Vat Kohen Ki Tiel Ish Zar, and then right afterwards it says, Vat Kohen Ki Tiel Almana Grusha V'Zera Ein La. So there, Gemara draws from that adjacency of the Pesukim that a Bat Kohen that becomes or weds an Ish Zar will result in these effects, which are the subsequent Pasuk, which is Ki Tiel Almana Grusha V'Zera Ein La. But Nita Tana, Kovra o Kovrato. Either he buries her, or she buries him. Now, obviously, that's what's going to happen any time in life. Obviously, one of the two spouses is going to bury the other spouse, but this means before their time, that they're going to bury them early in their marriage. O meviyado li de'aniyut. Or it causes him to be in grave poverty. Ini, is that really true? V'hama Rabbi Yochanan. So I have another member from Rabbi Yochanan. Arutze sheet asher. Someone who wants to become wealthy. Idbak bizaro shel Aron. He should get close to the descendants of Aaron. Koshukain, and certainly Torah v'kuna, if it's a Talmud Chacham, together with Torah and Kehuna, mi'ashar tam, then it certainly will make them wealthy. Gemara says, Lokasha, haba Talmud Chacham, haba Amaretz. It's a difference. If the Bat Kohen is marrying an Amaretz, that's considered to be an inappropriate zivug, an inappropriate suda, so it's not a sudat mitzvah. It also results in the zivug not going well. On the other hand, if it's a Talmud Chacham, then a Talmud Chacham, b'yichuso, is ra'uy to be together with the Zera Shel Aharon, and in that case, the Zivug will be good, and you'll end up with the resultant marriage will be successful, and actually might result in wealth, because of the connection to Aharon HaKohen. Now that has to do with the fact that, it's not mentioned here in the Gemara, but in other places, the Gemara discusses the fact that in the Brachot of Parshat Zot HaBracha, when Moshe gives the Brachot to Shevet Levi, to the Kohanim, says, Yasim Keturah Be'Pecha, V'Chalil HaMizbechecha. And the Gemara discussions from there about Yasim Keturah Be'Pecha, that the Ketoret was something that gave Ashrut, gave wealth. And that's why, first of all, they only allowed somebody who hadn't brought the Ketoret before to work with the Ketoret, since it was considered to be a Bracha for Ashirut, and therefore they wanted to spread the wealth. So in order to spread the wealth, they made sure that there was a new Kohen that did it. Only Chadashim, only new Kohanim came for the lottery when it came to the Ketoret. as well as the fact that Zera Shel Aharon, the descendants of Aharon, were blessed with that wealth. So if someone attaches himself to Zera Aharon, then they will be beneficiaries of that wealth. But that's only if they re'uim, if they are appropriate to be together with Aharon, to be together with the descendants of Aharon HaKohen, to match that type of Yichus. So Rabbi Yehoshua Nasiv Kahanto, Rabbi Yehoshua married a Bat Kohen, Chalash, he fell ill. Amar lo nechad le'ed Aharon, te'ad bak v'zarei? Aaron's not happy that I joined his family? Tahavi le'chadna ki'ano, that he'd have a son-in-law like me? I mean, obviously he wasn't his direct son-in-law, but he was saying that, how is it that he's not happy with someone like myself being part of the Zera of the Kohanim? I'm obviously not a Kohen, but he's a Talmid Chacham and he's marrying into the Zera. He thought it was appropriate Yichus, so why is he falling ill for marrying the Bat Kohen? Ravidi Baravin, Nasiv Kahanto, he also married a Bat Kohen. Nafkumine Trei Bnei Smichai. He had two children that ended up with Smicha, Rav Sheshit Breid Ravidi, Rav Shua Breid Ravidi. So that turned out well. Amra Papa, Ilno Sivna Kahanta Loit Adre. And Rav Papa makes a statement that, had I not married a Bat Kohen, I wouldn't have been so wealthy. My wealth comes from the fact that my Shidduch was with a Bat Kohen. Amra Rav Kahano, Ilno Sivna Kahanto, had I not married a Bat Kohen, Lo Glai, I wouldn't have ended up being put into exile. Amra V'hal Makom Tarogalita, who ended up going to Galup and ending up in a place that had more Torah. So he says, Lo Galai, Kedagali in Ashe. I didn't end up in Galut. I wasn't exiled the way that normal people go, which means voluntarily. I was forced to go. So first of all, what's interesting is Rav Kahana, you would have thought meant that he's a Kohen, Rav Kahana. So there are numerous Rav Kahanas throughout Shas, and it's obvious that this Rav Kahana is one that's not a Kohen, because otherwise, why would it be relevant that he's married to a Bat Kohen? He himself is a Kohen. So obviously he's not a Kohen. The second is that here the Gemara doesn't tell the story, but from what we're seeing here, it sounds like this is Rav Kahana, who is a Talmud Chover of Rav, that he learned by Rav in Bavel, and he was very bright. He was one of the top Talmidim in Rav Shiur, and he used to come and attend and protect Rav, which means that when somebody spoke inappropriately or acted inappropriately towards Rav, that Rav Kahana took care of them. So that's what happened one day. Some Amma Aretz or someone went ahead and spoke inappropriately about Rav, or did something inappropriate, and Rav Kahana interceded and took care of this individual. This individual wasn't so happy about how Rav Kahana handled the situation, and he went and spoke to the authorities. When the authorities found out about it, they wanted to get Rav Kahana and imprison him, so Rav Kahana is forced to run away to Eretz Yisrael. He leaves Rav and then goes to Eretz Yisrael, where he is with Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish, and he learns there. And he's known as the Rav Kahana, who is the genius from Bavel that came up to Eretz Yisrael. And later on, it doesn't work out so well. I think he returns to Bavel again later in his life. So the point being that he ended up being Galut. He was forced to leave Bavel against his will. He didn't leave willingly. He was chased out because he had to run away from the government officials. And that's what he's saying over here, that he thought that was the result of being married to a Bat Kohen. So he's describing this difficulty in his life to the fact that he married into a Bat Kohen, and maybe he wasn't worthy of being married to a Bat Kohen. So Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Kol Nehneh Misudat HaRashut Usof Kula. Anybody who benefits from a Suda that is not a Sudat Mitzvah, in the end goes into Galut, Shenamar, because here described in Amos, here is the people of the Shomron who are leading the good life, and they're in full of wealth, and things are going so well. And there in part of that description it says that they are Bochlim Karim Mitzon, they eat the lambs from amongst the flocks, Vagalim Mitoch Merbeg, and the calves from amongst the stalls, but they were eating delicacies and they were enjoying themselves, life was great. And then it says that these people, those individuals, Uchtiv, Achen Ataiglu Barosh Agolim, therefore you will be the first of those that go into exile, because you're leading this life of luxury, this life that completely is devoid of Hashem, and understanding what you're supposed to be doing, and enjoying the benefits of life and the luxuries of life, therefore you're going to end up in the gula. So he applies this to a sudat reshut, someone who is benefiting from olam hazeh, but doing it in such a way that he is not doing it l'shem mitzvah, but rather l'shem reshut, for his own benefit, for his own joy. And therefore it's considered to be inappropriate, and that's why he ends up in galut. Tanur banan. Kol tamid chacham amarbe sudato b'chol makom. Any tamid chacham that eats all over the place, Sof machrivet beito, he ends up destroying his household. So here, this is a Talmud Chacham. Either he's a Talmud Chacham, he's an individual who enjoys eating, and he loves to eat, and therefore he is patronizing people, in order that they give him food or that they should feed him, or it's simply that he is a Talmud Chacham, he's trying to engender goodwill with the people, and so instead of doing what he's supposed to be doing as a Talmud Chacham, he's going around and trying to win the favor of the individuals and eating with all these people. So this Talmud Chacham that goes around and eats everywhere and is joining meals everywhere, then in the end he destroys his household. He leaves his wife a widow. Leaves his children as orphans. And then he forgets his learning. And he ends up in a lot of discord. This happens because in order to maintain the lifestyle that he becomes accustomed to from always going around and searching for food or getting the luxuries from other people, having them support his lifestyle, is that in order to maintain his lifestyle, at some point he's going to have to leave his learning in order to support his lifestyle. And once he does that, his wife will be left as a living widow because he has to go away to make the money, and his children will be living orphans. He will forget his learning because he's engaged now in work and business, and because of that, he'll forget his Torah. He'll end up in a lot of discord because he'll forget his learning, or because of his business transactions, he'll end up in fights with his partners or with his business associates. And that which he says will no longer be heard. It's a chilul Hashem, v'shem Rabbo, and his Rebbe's name is Mechulal, v'shem Aviv, and his father's name, v'gorem shem Rali Olo, when he causes himself a bad name, ulavanav, and his children, ulavanav, and his grandchildren, atzov kol adorot, forever and ever, they're going to have this stigma associated with them. Mahi, what is this stigma, what is this name that he's going to get? Sam Rabbi Karulei, bar machim tanure, they're going to call him. Now, bar can either mean the son of, or bar can mean a person who does. Rashi says it over here that bar means the son of. Marsha translates it as bar being the one who. So bar machim tanurei, he's the one who's always heating up the ovens. And he's always got the oven going because he's always looking for food to eat. So they're going to call him the heating the oven man, or a man who's always heating up the oven. He's always looking for food. Rav Amar, bar merakeid bei kobe. He's going to be known as the pub bar dancer, because he's always going to be around from the bar to bar to get his fix, whether it's of alcohol or it's food, and he's going to go around, he's going to have to dance, he's going to do things in order to win his food. And Rapapa Amar, Bar Malachik Pinke, they're going to call him the plate licker, because he's the one who always doesn't leave anything over, he licks his plate clean, because he's so gluttonous, or he's Ravatan, he's a hungry all the time. And Rashmai Amar, Barmach Rava. He is the one who folds up his cloak or lays out his clothing and goes to sleep in the street. He's like a drunkard who doesn't have the ability to make it home, and therefore he just puts down his cloak, folds it up, puts it down wherever he is, and goes to sleep on the spot. But what you're talking about here is a description of an individual who is hooked, almost, I would say, addicted to the luxuries of life, whether it's food or whether it's wine. And what the Gemara is warning over here is such an individual will end up with those addictions, taking himself away from Torah and becoming a great Chilul Hashem. Because in order to get his fix, in order to maintain the lifestyle of whether it's these luxuries or these addictions, he's going to end up doing things that are a Chilul Hashem, and he'll forget his learning, and he will destroy his household as well as his Shem Tov and the shame of his family as well. Tanabanan. Olam yibkor adam kol mei sheyesh lo. Person should sell all of his possessions in order to marry the daughter of a Talmud Chacham. I'm assuming that means in order to provide for the dowry so that he can marry the daughter of a Talmud Chacham. Shim mate ogula, because if something chas v'shalom happens to him, he passes away, he has to go into galut, muftach lo shebanav talmidei chachamim, that his wife will ensure that his children grow up to be talmidei chachamim, because that's the type of household that she came from, that's the type of person that she is. V'alisa bat amaretz, and he shouldn't marry the daughter of an amaretz, because then if he passes away, he goes into galut, but of amearetz, then the woman's going to defer to the household that she grew up in, and she's going to bring up the children as amearetz, because they're going to go back to their father-in-law's house, they're going to go back to the household, the family of the mother, and the mother who is an amearetz, then will result in the children being brought up as amearetz. Tanurabanan, olam yimkor adam kol ma sheyesh, a person should sell all of his possessions, and then he should marry the daughter of a Talmud Chacham, and he should also marry off his daughter to a Talmud Chacham. Mashal, lein ve'a gefen, bein ve'a gefen. Davar Na'eh Umit Kabel. It is famous, this Gemara, because of the song that is sung at many weddings, which is Inve Agefen, the branches of the Geffen, Be'inve Agefen, that's grafted on another branch of a Geffen. Davar Na'eh Umit Kabel, that's something that is beautiful, and Mitkabel is accepted. That's something that will work. It'll grow, and it'll be successful. V'lo yisa bat amaretz, on the other hand, he shouldn't marry the daughter of an amaretz. Mashal, what is the parable there? Is lein ve'agefen bin ve'asneh. When you're trying to graft a branch or a vine from the grape onto a thorn bush, or the thorn bush onto the grapevine, davar ka'ur, that is something that is disgusting, something that is repulsive. Ve'eno mitkabel, and it's not accepted. Meaning, as Rashi says, lashomim, people hear that will say that this is a mismatch, this isn't the proper type of marriage. So you have here the inve'agefen, the idea that the anavim, that the grapes, when they are put together, that's a successful type of marriage, whereas when the grapes are put together with the thorn bush, that's an unsuccessful type of marriage. The idea being, obviously, that if the same type or of the same nature, then that's the type of marriage that will succeed. The idea of using the inve'agefen, which are the grapes, which is that grapes are the type of item that when they are brought together and they are squeezed, they produce wine, which is something that's better than the grape itself. And that's the concept here too. If you bring together the grapes and you squeeze them together, then you produce the wine, which is the beautiful offspring or the beautiful product of the grapes coming together and being squeezed together. And that's the idea of the mashal here. If you bring together two appropriate people who are marrying, then the offspring or that which is produced from that will be something beautiful, will be like the wine. On the other hand, if you bring a thorn bush and the grapes together, the offspring or the product of that union will not be something that is beautiful. And that's what's meant by the mashal over here. So now, Tan Rabbanan, Lo'olam yimkor adam kol ma sheyeshlo, v'yisa bat tamid chacham. And that he should go ahead and marry the daughter of a tamid chacham. Lo matza bat tamid chacham, if he doesn't find the daughter of a tamid chacham, v'yisa bat gedolei ador, to marry the daughters of the leaders of the generation. Now, gedolei ador is not simply the lay leaders of the generation, but rather, as Rashi says, anshei maaseh v'tzadikim. These are people who are righteous, people who are doing mitzvot. These are people who are serious about their kiyum ha-mitzvot and about their being shomrei Torah. V'lo matza bat gedolei ador, if he is unable to marry a daughter of the gedolei ador, yisa bat roshei knesiot. And he should marry the ones who are running the Beit Knesset. Lo matza bat roshei knesiot, yisa bat gabai tzedakah. He should marry the daughter of the gabai tzedakah, because they would only appoint someone to be the gabai tzedakah, who is ne'aman, who is believable, someone of stature, and therefore he should marry his daughter. Lo matza bat gabai tzedakah, yisa bat melamdei tiginokot. And he should marry the daughter of the one who teaches the children. It's a hierarchy over here, meaning that if your choice to pick the daughter of the, and here in the hierarchy, the one of the greatest stature, the one that is coming from the greatest yichus, that's what you should attempt to do. You should sell your possessions in order to pay for the dowry to marry the woman who is of the greatest stature. Below, isa bat amei aretz. And you should make sure not to marry the daughter of an amei aretz. V'nei shehen sheketz, unishotehem sheretz. Because they are something that is disgusting, repulsive. Unishotehem sheretz, and they're like these creepy, crawly things. And on their doors it says, Arush Shechivim Kol Behema, that cursed be the one who sleeps with any animal. So here you have, Rashi says, Shedomot LeBehema, that they're similar to animals, Shein Lehem Leiv LaHavin, because they don't have a heart to understand. So Rashi plays on the traditional explanation of what an Amaretz is. An Amaretz is someone who's not knowledgeable. This is someone who does not have the knowledge of Torah, someone that's not steeped in the understanding of Torah, but rather they are ignoramuses. And that's why they're called a behema, because a human being that doesn't use the intellect then is not very much different than the behema, than the animal. And that's the comparison over here. What you need to know is that the term ama aretz is something that is used throughout the Gemara and means many different things in the Gemara, ama aretz. There's no standard definition that you could say, oh, ama aretz, this is what it means. And that's important, because we're going to see as the Gemara unfolds here that it's clear that when we're talking about ama aretz here, we're not simply talking about someone who's an ignoramus over here, someone just not steeped in Torah. Because the Gemara here has some things or says things that are very negative in this case about Amei Aretz, things that you would be taken aback if you heard them just because this person did not learn Torah and was not engaged in Torah. So that's number one. Number two is we have even in the Gemara in Brachot, we have Tanaim arguing about what the definition of an Am Haaretz is. And over there we have one of the definition of Am Haaretz is someone who doesn't keep Tuman Tara. One is someone who doesn't mafrish Trumot Masrot. One of the definitions there is someone who's Karav Shana, someone who learned Torah, Velo Shimesh Tamid Chachamim, and he didn't serve Tamid Chachamim. So you see clearly, even through the Tanaim, that there's the definition of Am Haaretz runs a gamut of explanations as to what exactly the issue is with Amei Haaretz. Tosafot will take up the issue, we'll see it later on, and say that it's clear here that the Am Haaretz that we're speaking about here is no regular Am Haaretz, and we'll see why in a second in the Gemara. What I would suggest here is that there seems to be a great tension, which is going to seem to come up in the Gemara here, between the Amei Haaretz and the Chachamim. Part of that was the lack of acceptance by the Amei Haaretz of the Samchut, the power of the Chachamim, both to institute as well as the bearers of the Mesorah, and that's what brought this tension between the Amei Haaretz and the Talmidei Chachamim. That's clearly one of the problems. The other issue is that it seems to be that it wasn't simply just that these people were ignorant or they were lay people, but it seems to be that it was a religious movement in a sense. That this was more than simply a people who didn't always agree with the Chachamim or didn't listen to the Chachamim, but these are people who had a real issue with the Chachamim and might have even had a religious path that was opposite or ignored the Chachamim. I would compare it today in the modern day to other movements within Judaism that sprung up. Like today, when we talk about some of the approaches that the Chachamim or the Rabbanim had during the middle of the 20th century towards other streams of Judaism, they seem extreme to us. They seem like they're out of place. Why would you ever have such an approach to them? You know, we're all brothers, we're all part of Am Yisrael. But today, that's because most of those movements are pretty dead. There's nothing really happening with them. But when they were at their peak in the middle of the 20th century, when they looked like they were going to take over and be the only form of Judaism that there was, it was going to obliterate Orthodoxy and the world of Datiyut, in that time they had to take a much stronger stance against them. So in the time, or when in the process of when the movement is at its strongest point, then the Rabbanan at that time take a very strong approach or create a divider and put a wedge between themselves and that movement in order to separate. Now today, after the fact, when we live after the fact, when it's been proven already that those versions of the religion did not survive or did not do or did not flourish, then we look at it as being like, why were they so extreme about it? But that's because we're looking after the fact. And I would say the same thing here with regards to the Amei Haaretz, that it seems to be that there was not just a little altercation between them and the Chachamim, but it seems to be that there were strong religious tones to their machloket, and that now, after the fact, we look at it and say, that's the big deal. But obviously in their time, it was a serious issue. And that serious issue was that the Chachamim drove a wedge between them and the Amei Haaretz in order to show that there's a clear division in their approaches to Torah. Now, we're going to continue, and you're going to see here some very strong words with regards to the Amei Haaretz. Tanya, Rabbi Omer, Am Haaretz asur lechol basar. And Am Haaretz may not eat meat. Shneamar, because the Torah says, Zot Torah ha-beima va'of. This is the Torah of the beima and the of, and they darshan that. Kol osek b'torah, mutar lechol basar beima va'of. Someone who is engaged in Torah can partake of the animals and the fowl. Kosheno seik b'Torah. Someone does not engage in Torah, limud Torah. Sur lechol basar beima v'of. It's not allowed to partake of the animals of the birds. They're making a play on the word zot Torah. Again, this highlights that one of the differences between the Talmidei Chachamim and the Amei Haaretz, which is limud Torah. Their focus on the primacy of limud Torah, as well as the centrality of Torah to the lives of the Chachamim, the lives of the Chavirim, versus those of the Amei Haaretz. So Amar Rabbi Elazar, and this is going to be shocking statements now, Am Haaretz mutar lenochro, v'yom ha-kippurim shekal yopi shabbat. In Am Haaretz, you can go and basically tear him open, stab him on Yom Kippur that falls out on Shabbat, which would be like this year, the holiest day of the year, because you have Shabbat Shabbaton of Yom Kippur and Shabbat Shabbaton of Shabbat coinciding, and you go ahead and you're going to stab this person. Amar lo tamidav, Rabbi Omer l'shochato. Rabbi says that you can shecht them. Why are you saying l'nochro? Nocher is used in the Gemara as opposed to shechita. Many times we had this in Gemara and Chulin, when the Gemara wants to talk about a killing of an animal. That's not shechita, they call it nocher. So over here, he said nocher, but Rabbi said you should shecht him. So I'm like, zeh ta'un bracha, v'zein ta'un bracha. Why would I do shechita? Shechita requires a bracha, and it would be inappropriate to make a bracha over this type of killing. So therefore I would do it nichur. His point being that we're not going to give them that satisfaction of doing it through shechita, doing something that's a method of mitzvah, versus something that is considered to be a denigrated way of ridding oneself of these individuals. That's a very strong term over here. This already, what are you talking about, Amiarich, just because they're ignorant or ignoramuses, you're going to kill them? That sounds, seems to be extreme. And Tosafot addresses that right away. And Tosafot says, what are we speaking about over here? So he says, it has to be that we are speaking about here, the Amiarich are not your regular Amiarich. But rather, we're talking about here Amiarets that are over, number one, the Hachis, and might even be Mosrim, that they'd be people who are giving over people to the government, or that they were B'sakanat Nefashot. These were people that were dangerous, and that's why you're allowed to kill them. I mean, it's a preemptive killing because this person was very dangerous and caused Sakanat Nefashot. So you're ready here. Tosafot's trying to deal with the extreme words that we're hearing from Rabbi Elazar and say that you can't be talking about a regular Amaretz over here. You must be talking about something that involves pikuach nefesh, whether it's listim, someone's chashud al adamim. I mean, these are very, very strong words, and he, Tosafot says that it must be that the person is very evil. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to have such strong words. You would not say this about a regular Amaretz. Amar, Rabbi Elazar, Amaretz asur leitlavot imo bederach. Not allowed to accompany him or walk with him on the way. Shenemar, kihi chayecha v'orech yamecha. Because it says about the Torah that it's your life, and it keeps your days, meaning it makes your life long. It is the potion of life, the elixir of life, and then if one engages in Torah, that's what keeps them alive. Achayav lochas. The fact that he hasn't learned Torah means that he doesn't worry about his own life. Achaye chavira lo koshi, and he's not certainly not going to worry about your life. If he doesn't care about enough about his own life to take care of it, to learn Torah, then certainly he's not going to worry about your life. Amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Amar Haaretz mutar lekoro kedag. You can rip it open like a fish. Amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Yitzchak umigabo, you can even do it from his back. So again, this idea of killing these individuals or doing it in a denigrating manner obviously speaks to either one of two things. What Tosafot says, which is that we're talking about something where we're talking about sakanat nefashot here. This is an individual who is evil, evil to the core, but evil in a dangerous way, which is that he endangers the lives of the individuals here, and therefore you can take revenge or really protective measures to kill him before he causes problems. Or in the figurative sense, which is what I was speaking about before, which is that this distancing or putting a wedge between themselves and the Amiarets here, the Chachamim are making it clear that not literally that you can kill them, but they shouldn't be associated with these individuals. Tanya, Amar Rabbi Akiva, Shaiti Amaretz, when I was once in Amaretz, right, that's a famous story in the Gemara and Ketubot in Nidarim, where Bat Kavasavua sees Rabbi Akiva, who's a simple shepherd out in the fields, and she ends up wanting to marry him. Her father disinherits her because of that, and then he goes on to become the great Rabbi Akiva. So he says, when I was once in Amaretz, Amarti miten li tamech chacham v'nashkenu kechamor. Who would give me a tamech chacham so I can give him a bite like the way that a donkey bites? Mo tamidav, Rabbi Omar Kikelev. Why don't you say that you wanted to bite him like a dog? Amalem zeno sheikh v'shover etzem. A donkey, when he bites, not only does he bite, but he breaks the bone. Zeno sheikh v'shover etzem. When the dog bites, it simply just bites, but it doesn't get through the bone. So I wanted to bite them. I wanted to do a real injurious type of biting. That is like the chamor. So over here, Rabbi Akiva describes what we a sense of that this was not a one-way street. The hatred or dislike or animosity was a two-way street. The Amiarets felt about the Talmid Chachamim the same way that we're seeing the description of the way or the approach of the Talmid Chachamim towards the Amiarets over here. And again, it's interesting because now we're not talking about an Amiarets that's a Pekuach Nefesh. Here we're talking about Rabbi Akiva. Oh, the Gemara there describes as, but Bat Kavasuva said he's Tzanua, that he had great midot. And yet he still hated the Talmid Chachamim, which speaks to, as I said before, some sort of religious divide or movement of differential or divisiveness between the Amiarets and the Talmid Chachamim. Tanya, Rabbi Meir Omer, Ko Amasi Bitol Amaretz, someone who marries off his daughter to an Amaretz, Kilo Kofta Aminichal Defnei Ari, as if he ties her up and puts her in front of the lion. Ma ari dores v'ochel, just like an ari, and lion doesn't wait for its kill to die, it rips it apart and eats it right away. Vein lo boshet panim, and he has no embarrassment about that. Af amaretz, so too an amaretz, makau boel. He hits his wife, and then he sleeps with her. Vein lo boshet panim, and he has no embarrassment about it. So whether, I don't know if hitting her means literally, but even when he upsets her, he does not wait to be mefayeser. He doesn't ensure that she is placated before he gets together with her, but he simply gets together with her, ignoring her feelings, ignoring her wants. So if you give your daughter over to an Amaretz, then you're really putting her basically in front of the lion. This is someone who's not going to act with the proper etiquette or the proper approach, the way of Torah, which is that these are human beings, and the woman has to be respected for her feelings, and you have to take care of one's wife. You can't simply look at her as an object or an animal. So Tanya, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Yomalei Anu Tzrichim Lehem, L'Masal Matan, if we were not necessary for them, meaning speaking about the Ami Aretz, about the Talmid Chacham, if we weren't necessary for them, L'Masal Matan, to engage in business dealings with us, or because we purchased food from them, we are basically customers, Hayu Horgim Otanu, they would have killed us off a long time ago, but because of the economic benefit of us being around, they keep us around. So Tanya Rabbi Chia, Kol Osek B'Torah Lifnei Am Aretz, Kilu Bu'el Arusuta B'Fanav. Anybody who learns Torah in front of an Am Aretz is as if he is Bo'el, he sleeps with his Arusa, which would be something considered that would be unfathomable, that you would do this. Shenamar, how would you know this? Torah Tzivalan Moshe, Morasha. So what is that? Torah Tzivalan Moshe, my Torah was given to us Moshe, Morasha. Alti Kriyei Morasha, Ela Mi'urasa. Don't read as Morasha as an inheritance. That's a loose translation of the word. It's probably not the right translation, but rather call it Mi'urasa, that is betrothed. Meaning that the Torah is the tuba, basically, between Am Yisrael and Hashem. And here, if you go ahead and learn Torah in front of the Am Aretz, which the Am Aretz is also married to Hashem through the Torah, but he doesn't partake of it, he's not a part of the Torah. It's as if you're taking that which belongs to him, and in front of him, you're going ahead and learning Torah. You're making fun of him that he doesn't engage with the Torah. Now, G'dula Sinash, Sonim Am Aretz, Tamid Chacham, greater is the hatred that the Am Aretz have for Tamid Chacham, Yatomi Sinash, Sonim Obdik Chamim at Israel, more than the non-Jews have for the Jews themselves. And their wives have even greater hatred than they themselves. So this is something that we're familiar with, that sometimes that the within our own communities and within the Jews themselves, we come up with more hatred between ourselves and amongst ourselves than sometimes that our enemies have for us as a whole. And that's an unfortunate thing. That's what destroyed the second Beit HaMikdash. And unfortunately, it's still present today. And that's why we don't have the Beit HaMikdash, because of this fighting or this inner fighting amongst us, where there's so much hatred between different sects of Jews. Tana, Shana, Upiresh, Yoter Mikulan. If he was once a Talmid Chacham, and then left the ways and became an Am Haaretz, then he's worse than all of them. Now we know that's true in the Middle Ages. Many of the apostates, who were learned individuals who went and then converted to Christianity, became terrible, terrible prosecutors of the Jews, and put up courts and systems, and prosecuted and persecuted the Jews. So we know that that's the case, that someone who was once knowledgeable is even more dangerous than someone who never had any knowledge. Tanu Rabbanan, Shisha Dvarim Nermu Ba'amei Aretz, there are six things said about Amaretz. Eim Osim Lehem Edut, you don't give them something to testify about. Ve'en Rikablim Menu Edut, you don't accept testimony from them. Ve'en Agilim Lehem Sod, you don't tell them any secrets. Ve'en Manim Otam Apotropos Al Yitomim, we don't put them to be an executor of the estate of Yitomim, of orphans. Ve'en Manim Otam Apotropos Al Kubat Shal Tzedakah, you don't make them the person who's in charge of the Kibbutz Takav. Ain mitlavin imahem b'derech, you don't walk with them on the way. V'yesh omrim af ein machrizim al vedoto, you don't have to announce about something that he lost. You don't have to announce about it. V'tanakama, Tanakama says, zimnin tanafik minei zara ma'alya, sometimes out of the Am Haaretz comes a very good person. V'achile, and he'll be the one who benefits from you returning his aveda. Shenamar yachin, this is a pasuk in Iyov that talks about the irony, which is Yachin, a person will prepare, but Tzadik Yobash, in the end, the righteous one will wear it. So even though here it's the Rasha is doing all this work and preparing it, the beneficiary will be a Tzadik. And so the Gemara here suggests that could be a son of an Am Haaretz, son of Haaretz who returns to Torah, comes to Talmid Chacham, he could be the beneficiary of what you return to this Am Haaretz. So therefore you should return the Aveda to him. So what we see in this list here of the six items is a, number one, a lack of trust, that they're not considered to be trustworthy or nemanim. That's number one. Number two is that we worry about theft. And number three is we do not believe that they are able to keep secrets, that they are spreading anything that's told to them that they relay or tell over. They're unable to manage these things. So that's what we see from all the items that are enumerated in the list. And number two is an interesting thing is that you don't have to be machriz al aveda. You don't have to announce about their aveda. Now that's halacha and aveda. The halacha in Aveda is that you only have to announce, you don't have to be machriz in Aveda, but it's a Jew's Aveda. A non-Jew's Aveda, you don't have to be machriz on it. The Gemara in Bava Metzia discusses how do you know what happens in a city that's rov over the Chachavim, rov Yisrael. What do you do in those types of situations? Tosafot over here asks a very simple question. How do you know that it's an Aveda of an Amar? It's not to announce about it. If you know whose Aveda is, then you can give it back to them. You don't have to announce about it. How do you know? Oh, this is the Amar, it's Aveda, I'm not going to announce it. So Tosafot comes up, oh, you saw a caravan of Amar, it's passing by and it fell out of their caravan. So you know it belongs to them, so you don't have to be machriz on it. But otherwise, it's interesting. But I think more conceptually, what the Gemara is suggesting over here is that these people are, according to at least the one approach, that they're considered Yeshomrim, that they're considered to be outside the fold, almost in a sense. They're considered to be like non-Jews, that you're not machriz on Veda. Whereas the Tanakama believes that they do have a status of Jews, and there's a possibility that their offspring might return, or might something great might come of them. So we're not going to dismiss them completely, and we're not going to push them away so much that we won't have the hope of their children returning to us. V'chein mishi yatza. Now we're going back to the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, so too, someone who leaves Yerushalayim. Lememra, the Rabbi Meir savar kebeitzu dechashiv. Rabbi Meir sounds like thinks that a kebeitza, the size of an egg, is what's considered to be chashuv. Rabbi Yehuda savar kezayit nami chashiv. And Rabbi Yehuda, on the other hand, thinks that all you need is an olive size to be chashuv. V'yemini, is that really true? We have another Tanaic work where it seems to contradict this. Ad kamehim mezamnim. What is the size of food that must be consumed in order to make a zimur to bench? Ad kezayit. Rabbi Yehuda Meir, ad kebeitza. So the Tanakama, who is Rabbi Meir, says that you only have to have a kezayit to be chashuv. And Rabbi Yehuda says, ad kebeitza. So Rabbi Yochan mukhlefet ashita. Their positions here are backwards, and you have to reverse their positions to reconcile with the Mishnah in Brachot. And by Amar Olam lo tipo, don't flip their positions. Hatam bekrai plige. Over there in the Gemara and Brach Mishnah and Brachot, they're arguing about the interpretation of a pasuk. Over here in our Gemara, they're discussing, it's a logical argument. So the two don't have to be correlated. They're for different reasons. And since they're different reasons, they don't have to match. Hatam bikrai pligay over there, they're arguing about the psukim, or the drush on the psukim. Rabbi Meir Savar, the pasuk says, v'achalta v'savata uveirachta teshem lokech, the source for pikat amazon. Over there it says, achalta zu achila, that's eating. V'savata zu shtia, that is drinking. So therefore, achila bikizayit, and achila is a kizayit. And that's what it's meant by the achilah, because zayit is the threshold to require you to bench. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda savar v'achalta v'savata, achilah sheish basvia. The svia is modifying the achilah. It has to be eating that is satisfying. V'ezezu, what is eating that is satisfying? That is b'kebeitza. So b'kebeitza is the threshold for birkat amazon based on his interpretation of achalta v'savata. But there they're arguing about the interpretation of achalta v'savata. They're not arguing a logical argument. Whereas over here, Hachobis Varapligi, over here they're arguing in a logical argument. The Rabbi Meir Savar Chazarato Ketumato. We force you to return just like the threshold for Tuma. What is significant with regards to Tuma? Well, Tuma Tochlim is only conveyed at the size of a Kebeitza. And so that's what's considered to be significant. That's also what will require you to go back. Ma Tumato Abi Kebeitza, just like Tuma is only conveyed when it's the size of a Kebeitza. Af Chazarato Abi Kebeitza, so too. We're only going to require you to go back into your Shalim to burn it if it's the size of a Kebeitza. Rabbi Yehuda Savar, on the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda believes, Chazarato ke Isuro, that we force you to return because of the size of the Isur. The Isur is a Kezayit. My Isuro be Kezayit, af Chazarato be Kezayit. Just like the Isur is a Kezayit, so too, the requirement to return is significant already at the size of a Kezayit. We're going to make you come back from the size of an olive size. Tanya, Rabbi Natan Omer, Vezeh Kishtei Beitzim, that both of them are actually the size of two Beitzim in order to return. Lo Hodu Lo Chachamim. The Chachamim did not agree to his position. They did not believe that his understanding was correct. His understanding of this Mishnah, the explanation of the Mishnah was correct over here. Okay, we're going to stop over here.